Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. Tonight I'd like to offer a teaching around one of the best known stories from the time of the Buddha, and that's the story of Kisa Gotami and the mustard seed. Kisa Gotami was a woman from a good family, and although she was of the marriageable age, her parents had difficulty finding her a match because Kisa Gotami was tall and thin. And although tall and thin is very fashionable these days, in India of those times, and as in India today, tall and thin is not considered most attractive. What's considered to be most attractive is to be well covered, to look prosperous. And so it took some doing to find a suitable match for Kisa Gotami. Kisa is the Pali word for lean, so she was the lean Gotami, Gotami being her family name. But eventually her parents were able to find her a suitable husband, and she went to live in her husband's household, as is the tradition. But her position in the household wasn't really cemented until she was able to produce an heir for the family. And for some years she was unable to conceive. And so her status in the household was quite low. Her grip on the household status was quite tenuous until she was able to fall pregnant and fortunately produce a son. Only then was she considered to have fulfilled her duty to the husband's household. And so her situation improved, but then suddenly, unexpectedly, when her child was only about 18 months old, the child died. And Kisa Gotami was beside herself with grief. Not only the grief at losing her child, but because it had undermined her position in the family once more. And so she refused to accept that her child was dead. She insisted the child was only sick. And so she refused to allow the child to be buried. And she carried her child in her arms, wandering through the town, looking for someone who could give her the medicine she needed to give her child good health again. And of course, people who encountered her realized that she was crazy, that the child was dead. But because they could see her distress, everyone was as helpful to her as they could be. And someone said to her, "Well, perhaps you should go and see the Buddha. He's a very powerful teacher, and maybe he'll be able to give you the medicine that you need for your child." And so at the sound of the Buddha's name and the thought that he was a very powerful teacher, Kisa Gotami went straight away to where the Buddha was teaching. And obviously when the Buddha saw her, he realized that she was out of her mind and that an ordinary teaching wouldn't work with her. And so when she asked the Buddha, "Please, sir, my child is very sick, and I've been told you're a very powerful teacher. Is there some medicine that you could give to me to bring my child back to health. The Buddha said to her, "Yes, there is a medicine that I can give you for your child and for you." She was so pleased, so relieved. Finally, here was someone who could do something to help her. The Buddha said, "I'd like you to bring me some mustard seed so that I can make the medicine that you need." And she was again very relieved. Mustard seed. Mustard seed is a common ingredient in all the dishes of India, and it's very easy to find some. It would be like asking us to go and bring some salt and pepper, or maybe some Vegemite. If this household doesn't have it, well, next door is sure to have some Vegemite they can spare. So she was very pleased. Then the Buddha said to her, "But first you must make sure that you only bring me mustard seed from a house where no one has ever died." Oh, right. All right, I'm sure I can find something. So off she went, carrying her child with her. And sure enough, the first household that she went to, she explained to the people she had to have mustard seed for a medicine to bring her child back to health, and they were very willing to give her what she needed. But before they could go off to get the mustard seed, she remembered the Buddha's instructions. And so she said to them, But first of all, I've just got to check. No one has died in this household, have they?" "Oh, well, no, of course, just last year, Father died." Oh, well, then I can't accept your mustard seed. I'll have to go somewhere else." And so she went to the next house. And the same situation. They were very willing to give her what she needed. But when she asked them, "I just need to make sure that no one has ever died in this household." "Oh, well, no, just this year, Grandma passed away." Every household that she went to, the same thing happened. Mustard seed was available, people were willing to give it to her, but everywhere she went, she found that death had visited before her. She couldn't find any place where no one had died. And as she went from house to house throughout the day, desperate to find what she was looking for, it slowly started to dawn on her that what she was experiencing was not that special, not that extraordinary, because in some of the households, yes, it was father or grandmother who died, but in some of the households, it was little brother or my child or my young son or my big girl. Young ones had died, old ones had died, all ages. Every household, it was the same. And so she started to understand that it wasn't that death was so special. What was special about it was that now it had touched her. That's what she was experiencing. Death is universal, but when it touched her, it became something extraordinary. And so as she made her way back to the Buddha, she understood the lesson that he was trying to show her. And by the time she got back to him, she no longer wanted the medicine that was made for mustard seed. And the story goes that Kisa Gotami left the household life and became a bhikkhuni and eventually became enlightened, and her meditation subject was the subject of impermanence. She became fully enlightened and a great teacher. And this story of Kisa Gotami is traditionally told to help us to open to the fact that death touches everyone. It's a consequence of having been born. a part of life. And either we will be the witness to the passing on of those who are close to us and will be mourning their loss, or we'll die and they'll be grieving at our passing. One way or the other, there is going to be separation and loss. And so if we understand that death goes along with being born and is inevitable, then how are we going to live this life? If we understand that one day we're going to have to give up all the things that we've accumulated, that we've treasured, that we've put so much time and energy into getting, then maybe we won't be so attached to them. We won't be so caught up in that whole process. We won't be so entranced by the passing show of life. May help us to reorder the priorities in our life. The things that we're going to have to leave behind become less important. And then we ask ourselves, well, what can I take with me? I can't take my things. I can't take other people. I can't even take this body. All I can take with me is my mind, the state of my mind at the time of death. In Buddhist teaching, that is going to condition the arising of the mind in the next life. That's all we can take with us. So if we really understand that and accept it, then what's going to be important? What are we going to spend our time doing? Obviously, we have to spend some time making a living and supporting ourselves materially, but if we're going to have to leave all those things behind, maybe that's not where we should put the emphasis in our life. Maybe our priority should be making sure that the mind at the time of death is ready for the next birth. And one of the important parts of doing that, of being at peace, is to repair the relationships that we have. Any of the broken relationships, any of the relationships which aren't satisfactory. If we understand that one day we're going to have to face our death with the memory of those relationships, and we don't know when we're going to die, so when are we going to repair them, if not now, then we might make it a priority to do something to sort out those relationships which don't allow us to be at peace. We certainly know that we're going to die, but we don't know when and in what circumstances. We might have time to prepare. We might have time to go out and do some last-minute fence mending, but we may not. So when we're lying on our deathbed, are we going to have regrets about that? Are we going to have unfinished business? So what do I need to do in order to be at peace the time of my death? When we reflect on these things, we may change the way we live. And that's the purpose of this teaching. Not only to make us aware of death in an abstract sense, but to allow that understanding to affect how we spend the time that we've got. And this is the traditional teaching around this particular story. But recently, someone was giving me another perspective on this story, another level of meaning from this story, which I think is also very helpful in understanding our life and those the way of living our life which is for our benefit and happiness. And this person was telling me that they'd read a book where a teacher was talking about the story of Kisa Gotami and the image of her carrying her dead child in her arms and going from place to place looking for someone who could help her. And this image reminds us of what we very often do, is we carry our suffering with us from place to place, never being willing to put it to rest. And wherever we go, with our family, with our friends, work situations, any kind of new relationships, we sort of say, look at what I've got. Look what's happened to me. Look what I've suffered. Or, look what I've done. What a terrible person I am. And we carry it around and thrust it into other people, into other people's faces, asking them to do something with it for us. This is a very powerful image, and it's a kind of behaviour which I'm sure many of us can identify with. And we get to the point sometimes where we like to compare our suffering. My suffering's worse than yours. No one could possibly understand what I've been through unless they've been through it themselves. How could anyone possibly expect me to be happy because of what I've been through? Impossible. And so we get into this mindset where we think that our experience is unique and that no one else has ever been through what we've been through or could know what it's like to be me. And then how could anyone possibly expect me to do anything with my suffering, to do anything to become peaceful and calm? And this kind of idea of my suffering's worse than yours, it's something that we can get a lot of mileage out of because it actually closes us off to looking at what we can do with our suffering. Now, when we think that our suffering is unique and no one else has ever suffered like I have, then we are blind to the first noble truth that the Buddha taught. The first noble truth is that life is inherently unsatisfactory. Life isn't perfect. Sounds very simple and trite, but it's a noble truth. And we have to investigate that truth in the light of our experience. But if we think that our experience puts us outside the range of that noble truth, then we're not going to be willing to reflect on our experience and then use the teaching to find a way through it. So that's the first thing. If we think that our suffering is unique, then we are not open to the first noble truth which the Buddha taught. Now, this doesn't mean that in Buddhism we trivialize the suffering that we've all experienced, that we deny individual suffering. not at all. Especially if people have experienced traumatic events early in their life, as young children, when they have very little power to affect their situation, where they're very often other people are making decisions about their well-being, and very often as children we don't have all the information about what's going on, then any kind of trauma experienced as a child can leave a scar, can leave a scar for life. But even the worst scars can heal and fade away if they're given the right kind of care and treatment. If someone experiences a series of traumas, one after the other, then very often it bowls them over. It takes away any reservoir of strength to be able to deal with the slightest thing. So if someone, for example, loses a loved one and then becomes sick themselves, something as minor as the car battery being flat can really be just too much to deal with. And so we're not trying to say that we don't suffer deeply in this life and that some people have suffered extraordinarily. But if we think that that's unusual or peculiar or extraordinary, then we haven't seen life as it really is. And then if we try to quantify who's suffering the most, that also becomes impossible, because each one of us will have different strengths and weaknesses and different capacities to deal with what we experience, not only because of our innate strength and qualities, but because of the support that we receive from the people around us. So, for example, if we're trying to quantify who's suffering the most, just to give you two examples to show how difficult it is to think in those terms, how preposterous. Friends of mine had a child who had a congenital illness. And from the time the child was born, those parents knew that their child was not likely to reach beyond the mid-teens. And so for the whole of that child's life, those parents and that family struggled to come to terms with the likely early death of their daughter. And their daughter managed to live until she was 19, and then she died. Now, someone else that I know was driving her car with her daughter as a passenger, and she hit the loose gravel on the side of the road, turned the car over, and her daughter was killed. And she has to live with that loss and her blame of herself for the accident. Now, who suffered the most? The parents who knew from the beginning that they were going to lose their daughter? Or the parent who had their daughter and thought everything was fine and then suddenly lost her? We can't really help ourselves much if we try to quantify and compare our suffering with others. What we have to do is to deal with what we've got. And part of that is to be able to use the reflective mind to examine the suffering that we have in our life. The reflective mind develops from the kind of meditation practice that's as simple as being able to observe one's states of mind, observe the breath, observe one's body, and strengthen that quality in the mind which is able to stand back from our experience as an observer, witnessing it, developing some distance from it, some detachment, and then being able to reflect on that experience in the light of the Dharma. All of us construct an idea of who we are from the experiences that we've had. Our sense of self is born in relationship to what we experience in the world around us. Our internal reaction to the relationships that we have with the people and the things in this world. And from those experiences, we build a picture of who we are, of what life is like, of what life is about. What happens very often when we have trauma or suffering in our life is that we fix ourselves as permanently being something or someone, a person of some particular kind, because of that experience. That becomes the defining experience of our life. And everything from then on is filtered through that experience. So, I'm the person who's father abandoned me when I was young. I'm the person whose business went broke. I'm the person who had cancer. I'm the person who this. I'm the person who that. Or I'm the person who did such and such. And from now on, that's who I am. So things that happen to us and things that we do, we make that thing into something solid. Something solid which then influences how we receive the rest of our life. And also when we reflect on that thing, we make it into a fixed event. Something that we actually look at in the same way that we looked at it when we experienced it. It becomes impossible for us to look back on that experience and learn from it, unless we're willing to reflect. And this ability to reflect in the light of the teaching comes through especially developing the meditative practice. Being able to observe our experience in the present so that we can start to understand what produces my experience now. Where does it arise from? What influences it? What does it mean, me? What does it mean, my? What does it mean, I? And if we start to observe our experience in the present in that way, we will start to notice how the experience of I arises in relationship and in the context of contact between our inner world and the outer world, the world of people and objects outside ourselves. And it's in those relationships that we experience a sense of who we are. So, for example, what makes me happy? All the things that we do that we enjoy. eating food we like, wearing clothes that feel comfortable or that make us feel special, going to hear music or going out with friends, walking in nature. All of those things produce a reaction within us. And if we start to observe, we will notice that these reactions arise and pass away. They don't last forever, the unpleasant or the pleasant. And what produces this one reaction one day may not be produced by the same thing the next day. There's constant change. Sometimes we like it, sometimes we don't. So when we can observe our experience in the present moment, we start to be aware of cause and effect. Things influence how I'm feeling and therefore who I think I am. So if we have a run of good days and we're feeling good, then I'm a bright and happy person. I'm so positive and optimistic. And then we have a run of difficult days. Things don't go well. Things seem to be getting worse and worse. Oh, I'm in a bad patch. I must be one of those people who can never get what they want, can never get it right. So we start to identify ourselves as being a particular person, a particular way, because of the experiences that we have. If we can observe this in the present moment, we get an idea about cause and effect and about influences and about how we have different reactions to the same situation on different days, depending on what other influences are happening in our life. We start to see the fluidity of our experience and the fluidity of who we are. Once we start to see that in the present moment, it makes it possible for us to look back to experiences from the past which we've held to be fixed and solid, start to examine those experiences in the same way, in the light of cause and effect, different influences producing different results, and those results as well as those influences being subject to change, and the causes producing effects which then produce new causes. We can start to untangle this sense of me being just defined by one experience in our life, or our attitude to a person as being fixed and firm because of a particular experience that we had with that person at one time. Because that experience may have been fundamental to our well-being at that time, but we are still carrying that around with us now, as though there's nothing we can do to change that. And according to the Buddha's teaching, there is something that we can do. Once we understand causes and their effects, we can start to work on changing the causes in the present moment so that the effects that are produced are also changed. Now, this isn't just theory, this is life, this is practice. And someone gave me a very good example of this when I gave this talk at the nuns' monastery. They were telling me, when I was talking about how people compare their suffering, they said that they went to a family reunion some time ago with their five brothers and sisters. And one of their brothers said, in the course of conversation, who do you think suffered the most while we were growing up? It was a really tough time, but I think I suffered the most. And then each of the siblings went into their story about, no, why they suffered the most. And what it came down to was that they were all saying that they had suffered because their mother wasn't very kind and loving towards them. And the person who practiced had been reflecting on this. Everyone had this image that Mum was hard and tough and never put us on her knee and gave us a cuddle. And so the person who'd practiced had been reflecting on the conditions that were operating in their life at that time. And at that time, it was wartime. There was wartime rationing. The father in the household was away at the war. Mother was bringing up the five children on her own with rationing in difficult conditions where it was constantly cold and wet. And one child had the mumps and another child had the measles. They were all young children, so it was a succession of illnesses. And it was no wonder that Mum had no time to put them on her lap and give them a cuddle. She was just struggling to get through what needed to be done. So as this person reflected, she saw her mother's behaviour in quite a different light. Instead of thinking Mum was never caring and kind, she saw all the caring and kindness that her mother was giving to all of the children. And then the next step, which was very good practice and a sign of maturity in one's practice, she asked herself the question, if I'd been in my mother's position, would I have been able to do as well as she did, given all of those circumstances and knowing how I operate when things are not so good for me? And as she reflected, she thought to herself, well, actually, no, I couldn't have done as well as Mum did. It's amazing that she managed to get us all through those years and brought up. So in this way, this kind of reflection actually freed this person from any kind of resentment that she'd been carrying for her mother. My mother didn't love me. My mother didn't do what I thought mothers should do. All of that went. And then not only that, once she started to appreciate what her mother did, she realised that she wasn't actually that unloved child which she'd always thought of herself as. My mother didn't love me. What was wrong with me? There was nothing wrong with me. Mum loved me lots. She just had to keep going in a very busy way to get through what she had to get through. So this sense of being a hard done by child, that went away too. So her self-image actually changed. Someone else in the family who still considers that they suffered very badly under this hard regime found it very difficult to accept that they hadn't really been hard done by. They wanted to hang on to that image of themselves as having been treated badly and having missed out on what they needed in order to be well adjusted and happy. They had a vested interest in maintaining that, whereas the person who was practicing had a vested interest in being happy and finding that happiness through whatever difficulties they'd experienced. Now, someone else was also telling me an interesting thing that they'd experienced was with their mother, who was very unpredictable because of mental illness. And this person had a very unhappy childhood, and her mother was physically aggressive to her. And all the time that she held her mother up as being a terrible mother and herself as being an unlovable child, all she could remember in her memories of childhood were the hurtful things, the things that had harmed her. But when she started to reassess the situation in the light of causes and conditions and to let go of some of her anger and hurt, spontaneously what came to mind was the good times that she'd had with her mother. She hadn't been able to access those memories because she'd been weighed down by this sense of terrible mother who's hurt me so badly. And she said it came to her when she was singing nursery rhymes to her grandchildren. And she asked herself, how come I know all these nursery rhymes? Endless supply of nursery rhymes. And then she remembered, because my mother used to sing me nursery rhymes all the time, on the good days, between the bouts of illness. And so again, her idea of mother never loved me. Not only did she sing me nursery rhymes, she taught me to dance. And so more memories, positive memories came up, which were only released because she was able to reassess the whole situation and not fix mother as being absolutely terrible or herself as being that unlovable child. These are true life examples of what benefit can come from this practice. Sometimes when we experience terrible things in our life, we ask ourselves why. Why did this have to happen to me? And we look for explanations. Why did it have to happen to that person? They're so good. And very often we can't find any explanation. One explanation is that it's because we're born. And once we're born, anything's likely to happen. But the other way of looking at it is to perhaps start opening the mind to the Buddha's teaching that this isn't the only life that we have, that we've had. The teaching is that we've had countless lives previously. And the teaching is that things that we've done in previous lives are producing the conditions for this life. And so the reason that we can't find an explanation in this life could possibly be that it's the fruiting of some past karma, some past action that we've done and which we can't identify or locate right now. And this teaching may be one that you're not familiar with or that you're prepared to accept. But if you experience something that you can't explain, maybe it's an opportunity to just start opening up to the possibility that this might be the reason, the explanation. It's important because to accept what we've got in our life is the first step towards dealing with it. So for Kisa Gotami, there was nothing she could do to bring back her dead child. But by accepting the death of the child, gave her the possibility of putting the child to rest and allowing peace come into her own heart. So if we can't find an explanation, at least to be able to use the teaching on karma and rebirth as a way of helping us to accept, well, this is what I've got to deal with. How can I deal with what's right in front of me? And one of the ways of preparing the mind to do this is not to wait until it's a traumatic experience, something that's really overwhelming, but to start to look at some of the things in your life that aren't so important, but which you can't explain in terms of this birth. So, for example, I always wanted to be able to dance, but I never had a sense of rhythm. And I was talking to a dancing teacher just recently. And I said to the teacher, "Now tell me the secret. What's the secret to being able to dance well? Because I've always wanted to be able to dance well. I took lessons and I never could." And he said, "Well, basically, you've got to be born with it. A good teacher can help you, help you to improve, to get the steps right, but to really be a good dancer, you have to have that sense of rhythm." Now, why didn't I ever have that sense of rhythm? I wanted it. I tried hard to produce it, and yet it didn't come. Why is it that someone has green fingers and they can make anything grow, and yet someone else gets all the right pots, all the right soil, good plants, waters them, looks after them, and nothing flourishes? Why is it that someone has a musical ear or a talent for this or a talent for that? We can ask ourselves these questions. How can we explain it? Is it just accidental? That's not fair. So, maybe we can start to consider this is something that we've inherited from a previous birth. And if we can start to just consider that when things aren't so important, then if we do face situations which are very difficult to come to terms with, that we can't explain, then we may be able to accept it on the basis that maybe this is the fruiting of some past karma. To the extent that it allows us to accept what we're dealing with, then we can actually turn towards that difficulty and do what we can with whatever it is that we have to face. Means we don't have to look for someone to blame. We don't have to blame someone else. We don't have to blame ourselves. We accept what we've got and we do with it what we can. And this is the other level of meaning in the story of Kisagotami. Nothing to do with making the child well or bringing the child back to life, but accepting this is the situation. In the case of Kisagotami, putting the child to rest and getting on with her life. Doesn't mean that we forget about the child, but it means that we don't carry the child with us wherever we go from now on in our life. So this is the teaching which I'd like to offer for you tonight, and may it help us all on our journey, and may the merit of this teaching help us to attain Nibbana.